Hey, are we live yet? Are we live yet? Testing. 1, 2, 3. Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's online podcast with your host, Jan Irvin. Here we investigate the religious, the mysterious, the entheogenic, the shamanic, and the Gnostic with the small g. Haven't heard it someplace else, you'll likely hear it here. So sit back and relax. Take a trip through time and a journey through your mind as we investigate the ancient mysteries.
Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 14. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. I'm on the road this week, so please excuse the quality, but I wanted to make sure that this show got out on time. And while I've had this show planned for several weeks, I was surprised to learn that Max Freakout also read a letter from Jammin on a similar theme on his podcast number 65 this week. So please be sure to also check that out. I did want to mention that Max slightly misrepresented what I was saying in regard to Amanita muscaria, so I wanted to clarify that. What I said about Terence McKenna, which is in my book with Andrew Taji, was that he only took 5 wet grams and never recycled, and all the evidence anthropological-wise states that Amanita was always dried, and often the urine was recycled after it was consumed. Amanita muscaria contains a substance called ibotenic acid, which decarboxylates into another substance called muscimol when it is dried or when it begins to decompose. And muscimol, as far as we know, is not a natural constituent of living Amanita muscaria. It appears to be only found in decaying or already dried or dead amanitas. So I did want to clarify that point, and as well, muscimol is about 6 times stronger than Amanita muscaria. Both Wasson and McKenna failed to follow the anthropological data in that regard. Also, Clark Heinrich has discussed his month-long experience with eating them and building up an experience, a full-blown type of experience that he talks about in his book, Magic Mushrooms and Religion and Alchemy. And I think that Amanita muscaria is really something that takes a lot of practice and a lot of getting used to, and it's really something that needs to be studied more. I know many people who've had fairly large experiences with them, including myself, but they are not like the other substances out there. So one friend of mine who goes by the name of Dream Spore on the internet has an extremely large amount of experience with these things, and so hopefully one of these days soon I'll have him on the show to discuss that. And regarding today's show, some of you may be wondering what alcohol could possibly have to do with Gnosis and ancient shamanism. And, okay, I admit it, I'm a home brewer, so it's time to talk about beers. And some of the best beers that I've ever had, I made myself. But as you learn from this episode, shamanism actually has everything to do with brewing and fermentation. And in fact, fermentation and brewing is key to unlocking many of the ancient mysteries regarding shamanism and witchcraft and the ancient mystery religions, even part of the Eleusinian mysteries and things like that, and the strong wines and things that we hear about were often or were almost always psychoactive. In fact, the Catholic Church, as we will hear in this episode, brewed a very powerful beer called Gruet. and Gruet had very strong psychoactive substances in it. And we should ask ourselves, were the beer purity laws laws that, or were they created to keep beer pure, or were they laws created by the Protestants to keep the entheogens out? And here today we will learn that they were in fact prohibitive laws and not laws to help keep the beer pure. In this episode, I interview Stephen Booner, who is, in my opinion, one of the world's leading experts in this area. Booner is the author of, amongst more than a dozen books, Sacred Herbal and Healing Beers, The Secrets of Ancient Fermentation. Hang on, because I think this is a fascinating and striking interview, and one that will surely shock and surprise many of you. Donations this week go out to Mark, Jesse, Michael, and Brandon. I really appreciate that. Those of you who answer my call to donate whatever you can, I really appreciate that, and that's what keeps the show going. Every bit counts. Gnostic Media is not corporate media, and we survive on your donations and the small book and DVD sales that we get from the website. So each donation helps to contribute directly to these episodes and the show and the betterment of the program, and as well to help keep doing what we do and survive and pay the bills and things like that. So your help is really appreciated. Let's see. My newest book, The Holy Mushroom, the first 100 numbered and signed copies are sold out. I do have copies available that are autographed only. If you would like a copy of that, that is available from my website or from Amazon.com. If you buy it from the website, from my website, it is a little bit more expensive than on Amazon, but you are helping support the artist when you buy directly from me and from the website, and it does, once again, help to support this podcast. And let's see, Astrotheology and Shamanism, the first edition is completely sold out. It is also out of print. The second edition is finally in print. And I expect to have those sometime soon and start shipping those hopefully within the next week or two. But I'm expecting probably, hopefully, no more than a 3-week delay for delivery on those. There are numbered and signed copies of the color edition of Astrotheology and Shamanism available. The first 25 of those will come with a free DVD. Once again, that's for the color version. All of the combo DVD Astrotheology and Shamanism combo orders will from now on be shipping with the black and white version of that. Both the color and black and white versions are available on the website. Once again, please allow up to 3 weeks for those to be delivered. I will get those out as soon as they arrive. And let's see. Next week will be Chris Bennett, author of Sex, Drugs, Violence in the Bible, as well as Green Gold, The Tree of Life. Also upcoming is Judith Ann Brown, daughter of John Marco Allegro, and she will be discussing her book, the John Marco Allegro, The Maverick of the Dead Sea Scrolls, as well as the republishing of John Allegro's famed Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. Also upcoming is Professor Michael Winkelman from Arizona State and Ernest Werner, regarding his book, The Rod of Jesse, who is a former Christian minister of 50 years and former member of the Cornell University chaplain staff. And also coming up will be Carl Ruck from Boston University, Professor Carl Ruck from Boston University, for his second time on the show to be discussing his book, The Hidden World. And if you'd like to contact me directly, please contact me at contact@gnosticmedia.com. If you'd like to visit the website, please go to www.gnosticmedia.com. That's GNOSTICmedia.com. And you can also check out the Pharmacratic Inquisition DVD for free on the website. You can go to gnosticmedia.com for that, or the Pharmacratic Inquisition.com. That's PharmacraticInquisition.com, INQUISITION.com. and I hope you enjoy the show. This is a good one. Stay tuned. I'm here with Stephen Booner, who is the author of several books, including Sacred Herbal and Healing Beers, which due to my own studies into shamanism and entheogens and the history of psychoactive substances, I've felt that it was of utmost importance to give the audience an understanding of where brewing and fermentation and the history of psychoactive substances in wines and ancient beers and things like that, such as strong wine, what these things really are and how they apply. And I really think that, except for maybe a couple of researchers like Professor Carl Ruck and Stephen Booner and maybe Michael Hoffman, the field is really void of a thorough discussion on this topic. So, Stephen, I am very excited to have you on to present this side of research to the audience, and welcome aboard.
Hi, Jan. Thanks for having me on.
And could you tell the audience a little bit about yourself and your educational background, et cetera?
Oh, I never really fit into the boxes of life. So when I was and schooling actually never worked well for me, so I was much more interested in education, which is a huge distinction. So I did actually end up finishing a University Without Walls program for a bachelor's degree, and that was perfect for me because I made a list of all of the people in the United States I wanted to study with and then went and studied with them rather than having to deal with professors in a university. So I spent time with Buckminster Fuller and Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and just all kinds of people. And I focused basically on, my degree was in transcultural epistemology, basically looking at how different cultures know or relate to reality. And basically looked in part at the shaman as an archetype for human contact with the sacred. And so, but mostly I'm an independent scholar is what I am, and that's a real strong point for me. You know, we've kind of given up a lot of our authority to experts, and I'm very much in favor of people following their own intuitive self-wisdom to solve the problems that are facing us. I mean, experts are who got us into this trouble to begin with. So I'm a very much of an eclectic person and tend to pursue interests wherever they lead me.
Well, interestingly about this show is that this show, what I try and do is bring together the best of the amateur and best, or at least in my opinion, who I think are the best of the amateur or independent scholars, as well as some of the leading professors in the field. So this show has a large number of academics that participate as well as independent researchers, but the idea is really to be able to bring both sides together so that they can exchange research and ideas, because from my own studies and in my field of the entheogenic side of shamanism, I find that so many of the largest contributions have come from both the academic as well as the independent sides, and I see them as one whole and inseparable, but we certainly do always need to work on the research and push for a balance.
Yeah, you know, there really wasn't that much of a distinction until after World War II, and a lot of the great researchers were really independent scholars, and Jim Lovelock, who came up with the Gaia hypothesis in part with Lynn Margulis, he talked about that a lot in his autobiography about how if he had had to train in the educational system after World War II, he just didn't think that he could have done it. And so I kind of like that. The thing I found with a lot of the more university-oriented researchers is there's so many constraints put on where people can go, and the discipline lines between, or the boundary lines between disciplines, have really interfered a lot. So I do know that there's a number of researchers that are more open to interacting with independent scholars now, which I think is just great.
Well, that's what we try and do here, and so far I think it's been fairly successful. We've actually sort of a debate started from this podcast between Professor John Hupps from the University of Kansas with John Major Jenkins, and I think that was a very productive talk, and we're considering doing a couple of additions to that. But yeah, so you know, anyway, that's the general idea here. So how did you get into studying botany?
Well, I actually am quite an opponent of the whole concept of botany. More what you might consider me to be would be a vegetalista or a plant person. And plants have been of interest to me for a long time. And I suppose it all started when I, you know, with my great-grandfather, who was a botanical physician primarily in Indiana. He began practice in 1911, and that kind of thread of plants has been with me a long time, and spending time with him on his farm in rural Indiana. So there was that kind of going with an elder as a young child into the forests, and then when I left home and went out on my own, I moved into a tiny cabin up in the high Colorado Rockies for a long time and worked very much with the, you know, forgotten arts and skills and working with plants. And then that began to deepen a lot more in about 86 when I began specifically focusing on medicinal plants and working with them from a very different orientation than that of a kind of a reductionistic perspective. And, you know, one of the troubles that I have with botany and plant taxonomy in general is that it tends to look at the world as it's got kind of that whole reductionistic orientation of labeling rather than finding out what the plant really is from its own perspective. There's a great poem by the Buddhist poet Robert Aiken who said, "Watching gardeners label their plants, I vow to practice the old horticulture and let plants identify me." And that's more my orientation, really, to find out what's true in the world first rather than putting a matrix of knowledge on top of it. And so I've been working with plants as medicines in a real specific kind of focus and as kind of the rebar that runs through the ecosystem of the planet for, you know, about 20, 22 years now in a real focused way.
Why fermenting and alcoholic intoxicants?
Well, that was, you know, I'd gotten into, you know, the 60s were an interesting time, and all of us, we thought we could do anything, you know, and we did. And, you know, one of the things that was going on back there is everybody, they began kind of reclaiming areas of interest that had been prohibited for a long time. You know, midwifery, herbal medicine, a lot of things. And part of that was the whole home brewing movement that began to take off back in the mid, late 60s and early 70s, which was against the law then. And so, of course, I thought, oh, that's fascinating. So a lot of friends of mine and I began fermenting various beers and a lot of actually pine and spruce ales and juniper ales were of interest to me. And then much later, one of my editors really suggested, she said, "I know you used to do that a lot, this a lot, and I'd really like you to write a book on it." And it tied into my other interest of plant medicines and plants as teachers and as psychotropics, and so it just kind of was a nice expansion of something I was already doing, really.
Well, as a home brewer myself, and as somebody who also has an interest in plants and things, I think you've probably got the most fascinating book on brewing that I've yet come across, and I've probably got at least, I don't know, not a huge collection, but 8 or 10 books on it here beside me. And I certainly applaud you for presenting such an in-depth and unbiased study into ancient brewing.
Thanks. You know, it was an interesting thing to do, and because I was kind of outside the whole brewing establishment, I could come at it from a really unique orientation. There was a lot of kind of a Germanic approach to brewing and writing about brewing in this country, and it was very just very scientific. There wasn't a lot of juice or moistness to it, really, not a lot of poetry. And so because I wasn't in that frame, it allowed me to come at it from a really different perspective, which, and the book continues to sell really well every year, and I think that's, it represents something that people were hungry for, kind of a way to get out of the statistical mentality and begin to approach it as a, as an art form with some of that moistness back in there again.
Well, for most people, wouldn't it seem that it would be a conundrum to talk about healing herbs and alcoholic beers in the same book, in the same sentence even? Isn't that a paradox?
Well, it is. It is interesting that people don't realize the really long tradition of fermentation, for one thing, and of the really broad use of plants in fermentation. And, you know, I'm guilty of that kind of strange thing. I find every year weird boxes I've created inside myself where I don't allow things to go across boundary lines. And this was one of them. Even though I'd been working with herbal medicines for some time, it never occurred to me to ask what hops did if you put it in beer. So, I mean, I had that kind of sequestered. And so then beginning to look at the whole fermentation thing, it turned out, of course, that it was a much more ancient and broad kind of discipline, like many things are, if you really begin to look at them closely. And the other thing, of course, I ran into right away was the sort of weird judgmentalness that's going on in our culture now about fermentation. And there's a lot of urban myth about it that just isn't accurate at all. So as I begin to put herbs with that, in a way, in a sense, you're right, it began to collapse this kind of healthy, you know, alternative to pharmaceutical technology to this thing that a lot of people in my community were starting to have judgments about, oh, alcohol's bad and stuff like that. And one of the things this book did, it really began to rekindle a little bit of a broader look at fermentation and kind of outside that really limited perspective of, oh, it's really bad for you, and, you know, indigenous people never drank and stuff like that.
That was one of the most fascinating things that I had thought, because, you know, in our society, we always hear that the white man corrupted the Indians by bringing alcohol here, and in your book you show that that's completely untrue, that that the Americas had a great history of brewing.
Yeah, almost every tribe in the United States, North America, fermented, and the more access they had to sugars or concentrated starches, then the more they would be into fermenting. And, you know, there were certain areas in the United States that I couldn't find any evidence for fermentation, but those were extremely rare. Almost the only culture that I could find no evidence of fermentation for were the Australian Aborigines, and I thought it was fascinating that they're the only one where I couldn't find that, but they're also the only one that had the concept of dream time. So I've always kind of wondered if there's some connection there. But basically, you know, we're all kind of stuck in this weird way. We're born and we're taught all these things, and we're given this picture of reality that we grow up with. And most of us know that the picture is not really accurate, but it sort of works as our programming for the way, you know, we operate in the world. And we're given these things, which I tend to think of as cliche thinking. We kind of ingest it whole form, and then we just see the world through that matrix. We never think about it. And one of those is this whole concept of that Indians never drank, and we ruined them, and we brought this bad thing, and stuff like that. And like most simplistic views like that, you know, people have a tendency, they want to try to find one picture answers, an easy black and white kind of a deal. But whenever, I guess I'm old enough now at 56 to know that when I get to a one picture thing like that, some sort of cliched thinking, it masks not only the complexity of the world itself, but also there's always something kind of a repressed knowledge or repressed truth that's hidden somewhere under that that possesses tremendous energy. So, you know, I have this bad habit of poking into areas of cliche thinking and finding complexity, which irritates people on the right and people on the left pretty much, you know, equally.
I would certainly fall into that category myself. Quickly on the Aborigines, are you aware of an herb or bean that they use called peturi? I believe it was...
No, I'm not.
It was Marlene Dobkin de Rios who published that. I believe that was in her book, Hallucinogens and Culture. It's in that book. But if you want to send me an email after the interview, and I'll see if I can find the reference for that for you.
Yeah, thanks.
So what is mead?
Well, mead is a fermented beverage made from honey, and it's probably one of the oldest fermented beverages that there is. You know, when we start getting into this and you start tracing back in historical time, things begin to fuzz out, you know, because we go from written into oral tradition and then even into more almost myth tradition that's even more ancient. And so it's hard to tell, but, you know, just kind of an easy, quick and dirty on it. Honey probably was one of the very earliest fermented beverages because it's a concentrated sugar. So, you know, if you could, you know, get there and get the bees away from it enough to get a hold of it, pretty soon if you mix it with any water, it's going to start fermenting. Sugar, when it's concentrated as strongly as bees concentrate honey, it won't ferment. It's very antibacterial. It's a rather remarkable substance, sugar is. But once it's diluted, then it'll begin to ferment. And, you know, people love sugar, and no matter what culture, we're biologically driven to want sugars. And so I'm sure people would collect that like they might have done, you know, with different plants that are particularly sweet. But in any event, mead was one of the earliest fermented beverages.
How is mead related to the mythological stories such as Odin or Wotan?
Well, a lot of the northern cultures like that were focused around that particular earth-centered mythology, mead played a hugely important role. When you start looking at different cultures, you might, you know, to just loosely, you could say they're animistic pantheists, perhaps. You know, that's kind of a term I sort of like. And Odin's a particularly interesting guy. I am very fond of him because he is a god. He possesses these tremendous powers, but he also has all of the limitations and weaknesses of human beings. So he's quite an instructive teacher in many respects. And many of the Norse gods and the Norse cultures drank mead a lot. It was one of their primary kind of things in that region, Denmark, northern Germany, all around in there. And the meads were fairly fascinating. When you ferment anything, it doubles at least the protein content of whatever it is you're fermenting. So it becomes a very potent food, a very good way to preserve a protein source for use any time of the year. And honey itself is extremely nutritious. So they would get this fermented beverage that would be very enervating and very strong. And, you know, as soon as you start touching into the origins of fermentation, every culture in which it appears says the same thing, that it was a gift from the gods or gift from sacred realms to human beings. The reasons why it's given to human beings is, you know, fairly broad, but it pretty much comes down to, you know, the human predicament is a tough kind of situation, and, you know, they took pity on us and gave us this thing. And in addition, the consumption of a fermented beverage of alcohol like that, it does activate certain portions of the brain and certain perceptions that aren't activated otherwise. So it's easy to see how that would get into that. It kind of is a stimulant for certain kinds of communication. And you see that thread in the Norse mythology too, when they talk about the consumption of mead. It not only makes the body stronger, but it makes the capacity to perceive in certain ways much stronger.
Did the Native Americans have these same sort of stories that the gods gave them fermentation as well as things like peyote and stuff?
Yeah, pretty much whatever. I mean, yeah, if you get a look at the Papago Indians who fermented, and I have to apologize, I can't really keep track. A lot of the native cultures in the United States have been changing their names to reflect, you know, more accurately what they would like to be called, and I'm not really up on all of them, and I know the Papago have changed theirs, but they're located down in, you know, southwestern Arizona, and they work with saguaro cactus a lot, and so they, every year, for centuries, would harvest the fruits of saguaro cactus and ferment those. And they have very strong mythologies about how that was brought to them and why it was brought to them and the gift of fermentation, very similar to the Norse, but of course shifting for culture and location and plant, basically.
Who or what is heather?
Well, heather is one of the major different kinds of meads was made from heather honey, and heather is extremely common through Scotland and northern England and all up in through there. It's a particular kind of plant, a low-growing, shrubby kind of spiny sort of sticky thing that has these remarkably beautiful flowers with a tremendous aroma. And heather honey is a very unusual honey. It's more kind of gelatinous rather than liquid, more like a what's that horrible stuff? Jell-O. I haven't eaten any in years, but
neither
I remember what it looks like. So,
right.
You know, it's sort of like that. It's very, very high in protein and a number of other things, but, you know, there's many traditions in that area of tribes. The indigenous culture in that region, the Picts, used heather honeys to make very potent meads that were called the Mead of Inspiration, for instance, and they were known to be highly inebriating and very specifically psychotropic. And so that has a very long tradition, and it turned out when there was a guy named Bruce Williams, a Scottish guy, who started making heather ales again, and when he was first working with it, he had some people analyze the heather honeys and the pollens and the heather, and found out they definitely are, you know, mildly and reliably psychotropic. So the historical stories that the Romans told about the mead of inspiration that the Picts had, it certainly has a root in real reality.
And I think you mentioned in your book that the Picts are where we get the word picture.
Yeah, they had, there's a lot of really interesting words that have come down to us that most of us don't know what they mean, but they tended to be, embellish their bodies pictorially, and that's one of the reasons that that word came down to us that way. And I feel in a lot of ways they're probably the origin of the myth of dwarves. They were short people and you know, and they drank this amazing heather honey, and so they kind of fit some of that myth image of the dwarf that is, you know, that Tolkien developed so well in Lord of the Rings.
I think there may be some overlap there with some more of the entheogenic myths with the mushrooms and the hidden worlds and things like that there as well. In that regard, I'm actually going to be interviewing Professor Carl Ruck regarding his book, The Hidden World, which actually touches on some of that too. So it'll be nice to actually bring these two views together and in that regard.
That's great.
What are the benefits of, you know, you mentioned some of the benefits are, you know, it's got a lot of protein and things like that, but what other benefits does honey and bee products have, if any?
Well, honey is a really remarkable substance, and I mean, just to give you kind of a right off the top sort of medicinal use of it, if like, for instance, in Mexico, where they don't have access to a lot of technological health care, honey is often used to on skin abscesses, like in the buttocks, that'll be as big as a fist going to the bone, for instance. And just covering that with honey will stop all of the infection, and it generates muscle and skin restoration so that there's virtually no scarring. And I've used it myself for burns and quite a lot of things. It's a rather remarkable substance that way. And part of the reason I mentioned, because the sugar concentration is so high, it's naturally antibacterial. But another thing that you have to understand about honeys is that the bees with a wildflower honey, they go and collect these nectars from a lot of different flowers, maybe anywhere from 10 to 100, depending upon how many plants are in flower in that particular region. And then they go into the hive and they deposit the nectar, and then all of the bees wave their wings very rapidly to create a kind of a fan effect to evaporate the extra moisture to turn it into honey. And what you're really getting is not only concentrated sugar, but you're getting all of the chemical compounds that are in nectar, and there might be 40 or 50 chemical compounds per plant nectar that are concentrated as well. So you're getting this wide range of antibacterial compounds, mucilaginous compounds, skin healing compounds, just a tremendous range. So you're looking at, in some ways, you could consider it the first concentrated pharmacological product, you know, made by bees. And so when you put that on wounds or anything like that, it's got tremendous impacts. Other bee products like propolis, which is what they line their hives with, they tend to collect that from very antibacterial trees, and they line their hives to try to keep infection out of the hive. Royal jelly is an extremely good immune stimulant and has a lot of growth hormone dynamics. So in the old days, when they would make a full hive mead, they would tend to take the entire hive and boil it, and then the wax would go to the top, and they would then lift that off as it cooled, and you would have this hive mead that would have the honey compounds, some propolis compounds, royal jelly compounds, and then, of course, bee venom, because there would be a bunch of bees in there as well, and bee venom is also a very potent substance. So you get this tremendously pharmacologically active substance that has incredibly ancient uses medicine.
So you mentioned that just about every culture that you came across brewed some type of beer or fermented drink. Is that correct?
Yeah, you know, the thing is, you know, our culture, I think this Puritan thing that's gone into our culture has just got way, way out of control. And the thing is that every culture, the people, it doesn't matter where they live, in what kind of culture, what kind of geography, whatever, people have a drive toward the consumption of psychotropic substances, substances that will affect consciousness. And fermentation, alcohols are one of those, psychotropic plants are others, and the plant psychotropics go along a huge, tremendous range of very mildly impactful to very deeply impactful. But human beings, no matter what culture they're in, are drawn toward that dynamic. And most people don't realize that all living organisms on this planet are very similar in structure. And so Jagadish Bose, working in the late 1800s, early 1900s in India, won the Pulitzer, the Nobel Prize for his work. You know, he was able to look at the reactions of plants to various substances. So one of the interesting things he did was he took a large full-grown tree and he covered it with a tent, and then he put chloroform in there and then anesthetized the tree, dug the tree up and moved it, and the tree didn't go into shock, which is just fascinating. And so he began testing a lot of substances, and he found that trees will actually get drunk on alcohol just like people do, and they have the same kind of slurring of speech and movements for their particular kind of language. And so when apple trees drop apples or fruits are dropped on the ground and they ferment and it rains and the alcohol goes into the soil, the plants get drunk on it just like we do. Bees and birds, all kinds of animals will eat fermented fruits and become intoxicated.
So you're actually saying that alcohol is not man-made?
No, alcohol is a natural substance. It's made by yeast. People don't have anything to do with it. We've been domesticated by yeast to make alcohol. It's not the other way around.
Well, there's such propaganda out there that that alcohol is a man-made substance. So an apple falls from the tree, it ferments and it creates alcohol in the
right. Of course, because it's got sugars in it, and so there's yeasts that begin, and bacteria both, that begin fermenting that, and they produce, and yeast, when they eat sugar, they produce two waste products, alcohol. Well, they produce a few more than that, but their primary waste products are alcohol and carbon dioxide. You know, they also produce a lot of B vitamins, and then the yeast bodies are really high in protein. But their waste products are alcohol and CO2. So it's a very natural process, and most organisms on the earth respond to alcohols. It's just kind of a modified sugar in a sense. And so all organisms can take it in, and every organism gets drunk in a very similar kind of way when they consume alcohol.
Yeah, aren't bees kind of
natural, very long?
Aren't bees themselves kind of aren't the bees themselves kind of prone to getting drunk?
Oh yeah, bees get drunk. And if you sit out with, sometimes I'll go out with a mead and I'll sit and drink it, and the bees come over and start drinking it. They can't keep away from it. They're very fond of it. And bees do get drunk. And all of our nervous systems, most people don't realize this, plant nervous systems are very similar to human beings, for instance. They create and produce inside themselves neurotransmitters identical to the ones in our bodies, and they do the same thing. They facilitate nervous system function in a plant. So when anything goes into a plant, like an alcohol, it begins to affect that nervous system function, just like it does us. Plants get high in psychotropics just like we do. So there's not really that boundary line, that one system, that one picture answer that everybody wants about, oh, we're human and everything else isn't. When you really start looking at it, that boundary line is not as clear as people think. Really what we are is we're an earth organism like everybody else here, and anything that's going to affect one part of the earth, if it affects us, it's going to affect everything else.
Well, I also find it interesting that both plants, it seems that just about all plants and all mammals create dimethyltryptamine, which is one of the most powerful psychotropic drugs there is.
There is a fundamental need for all organisms on this planet to ingest substances which change awareness. When plants ingest a psychotropic, which they do regularly and under various circumstances, or alcohol or anything you want, it changes the perception of the organism, and that's a necessary thing. The reality itself is so incredibly complex and so deeply layered that human beings are made, like everything, are made to be extremely complex so that they can perceive the many layers that make up the reality matrix in which we exist. And one of the things that helps us do that is periodic contact with substances that change the way we perceive the reality that we're taking in. Now, we have a lot of options for changing perception without using psychotropics. Nevertheless, they're a functional and irremovable part of every ecosystem on the earth, and they're there for a reason. It's because reality, when you start to get into it, I mean, you asked about my education and training earlier. One of the things I'm fascinated by is the nonlinearity of nature. Like, organ systems are nonlinear processes. They don't, our heartbeat isn't just regular all of the time. Our temperature isn't regular. Our organs actually are sensing their environment all of the time, and they change their level of functioning from moment to moment to moment. And everything in the ecosystem, for instance, is like that. So you can't really approach nature as this linear dynamic, A to B to C. It's operating on many levels simultaneously, and part of the function of psychotropics is extending awareness so that we can perceive those different kinds of levels of functioning. And the same is true for plants. Their sensitivity of awareness allows them to respond to their environment with much greater sensitivity, just like it does for us.
In your book, you talked about, since we were talking about bees and things getting intoxicated, I wanted to talk about elephants. In your book, you actually talk about elephants knocking over palm trees and then putting a dent in the side and letting it ferment to get drunk.
Yeah, elephants, this whole thing about man is the tool user, what a joke. Animals have been, using tools for a long time, and, people find out more and more all of the time as they begin to look how pervasive that is and how much different beings on the planet work with their environment. And elephants are a great example. They're extremely susceptible to alcohol. They love it a lot. And palm trees have some of the sweetest sap on the planet. So elephants have been known to go into the jungle and they'll knock over a palm tree and then they step on its trunk and they create this kind of foot-sized depression in the trunk. And what happens is then the palm sap collects in there and then begins to ferment in the jungle heat. It ferments fairly quickly. And the elephant just waits there until it's fermented and then consumes it and gets intoxicated.
How old is...
Everybody loves to drink.
How old is brewing, would you say?
I think it's as old as people. It's certainly as old as recorded history. And when you go back through the Egyptian civilization or the Aztec, brewing was woven into every one of those cultures. You can't get back to a place where the concept of brewing didn't exist unless you're looking at really, really ancient origin stories of people where they say, oh, people climbed up out of the earth and, that's how human beings first got to be here or something like that. But when you look at any kind of culture in existence at all ever, fermentation has been there. So I'd say think about it. Just because, we have this kind of modern society now, people aren't any smarter or dumber now than they were 10 or 100,000 years ago. People are people, and they've been pretty smart for a long time. Coming up with the concept of fire or anything else and fermentation, it's going to be one of the earliest things that happen to people just because of their drive to interact with food and both concentrated starches and sugars. There's no way that they could avoid running into fermentation extremely early on. And so they left out, some of the old stories, which I'm not particularly into, these cause and effect kind of stories of the ancient past, but sometimes they're sort of useful. And the whole concept of leaving out a bowl of gruel and then it ferments and you drink it the next day and get high, it's not going to take but 10 minutes for the guy to go around and tell everybody he knows that, this is really cool. You got to try it too.
So there's just another question that I was going to ask here, and I just forgot what it was. I'll come back to it anyway. what are the different types of beers out there?
Well, that, when you start talking about that, then you start getting into the, this kind of labeling stuff. It's sort of like, a grammarian labeling language, it's and everything's in its place. It's really not that cut and dried. And especially now, there's not that much distinction. There's ales and there's beers and there's wines and they're all basically fermented beverages. And that's how I tend to think of most of them. I tend to make my distinctions now between the substance that's being fermented, if it's a naturally sweet substance like honey, it would be a mead. If it's like a grape, it's going to be a wine, or a fruit, it'll be sort of a fruit wine sort of thing like that. Or if it's made from a starch, which is when plants accumulate sugars as energy sources and food nutrient sources, and to protect them from yeasts, and because everything loves sugar, they convert them into starches. And so that's how they kind of store them, and starches are much harder to break down. So when you start getting into starches, a lot of the beers in existence now are made from starches like barley or roots like manioc, for instance. Tree saps like maple sap are naturally sweet. So, you know, they're considered an ale or a beer as well, but they're kind of the tree sap segment is a little different. So you can see there's kind of a range there, and I just sort of group it like that, whether it came from a plant or whether it came from a sugar, like a fruit or something like that myself. I don't make much distinction between ales and beers, which a lot of brewers do now, and they define those whether the yeast they're using is top fermented or bottom fermented, but it just seems like a ridiculous waste of mental time to me to even make that distinction.
You talk about corn beers in your book, and chicha, and the discovery of some of the brews down there and how they're highly prized. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, corn beers are chicha, and they're still fairly prevalent all through South America. And they're, from what I understand, I'm not an expert on them, but I haven't been able to go down and taste a huge wide range. The taste range is apparently fairly phenomenal, and some of the communities are extremely good at making very elegant corn beers. And traditionally, the way it's made is, you know, the corn is grown, and then the kernels are dried and ground, and the women tend to sit around, and then they take that, you know, dry powder, the grain, and the flour, corn flour, and they put it in their mouth, and they soak it with their saliva, and then they form kind of, it's almost like a dental plate or something, and then they pop it out of their mouth and let it dry. And the reason why they do that is our saliva has an enzyme in it whose only function really is to convert starch to sugar. And plants do the same thing. When a plant seed will be a lot of starch stored in there for the young plant when it begins to grow. And when the young plant begins to grow, it releases a very similar enzyme which converts that starch to sugar that it can use as its nutrient growth substance until it gets leaves out, then it can start doing photosynthesis. So, you know, human beings discovered this a long time ago, that their saliva could convert starch to sugar. So what they do is they'll sit around all day and begin this process by, you know, what I just described. And then what they do is they take those things and put them in water and make a wort just like you would for a regular beer. And that, they put the yeast in there, and that begins that conversion process of the starch to sugar. And that's pretty much how it's made. And they'll add various kinds of plants or fruits or things to get different kinds of outcomes. But it's basically around that process. And the Aztecs, you know, and the Mayan tribes and a lot of the people down in there that were oriented around corn made a huge amount of corn beer, and it was one of the primary kind of trade items. It was huge in that culture, in all of those cultures.
So what was the impact on these cultures, nutritionally speaking, by the puritanical Christian missionaries and things like that, going in and outline these types of beers in many areas?
That's one of my kind of like soapbox things. I mean, I'm so irritated by that. Like, Christian missionaries would go down there, and they did this in Africa with the same kind of impacts, and they would say, oh, you shouldn't drink, and blah, 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 blah. Well, as soon as they managed to get all of these alcoholic substances banned, a huge number of diseases that were never known in those cultures began to sprout up. Malnutrition became more prominent. there was a severe loss of B vitamin source because these generally in the older fermented beers, I want to make this point, the yeasts were the beers weren't purified, so the yeast would still be in there, like you see in some bottle fermented beers now. There'll be a thin layer of yeast on the bottom, like in Chimay ales, for instance, or home brewed ales. And so what happens is people would be consuming that, and they get massive B vitamins plus a huge amount of protein plus a lot of other nutrients from whatever the fermented beverage is being made from. So they begin to get pellagra, beriberi, a number of other things. And then, of course, they would try to bring in modern medicine to correct the deficiencies. And it's kind of this downward spiral into ridiculousness and bad health. But yeah, it's a really bad thing. It's kind of a perfect example of the law of unintended consequences. People with, you know, oh, here, let me help you, and they put their good intention behavior, force other people to respond to it, and then, you know, they find out there's all of this other stuff that happens because they've only got a one-picture view of the thing. They don't understand really about fermentation. And, you know, I worry about that in this culture, too. Our beers aren't generally as healthy as they were in indigenous cultures, though we're moving toward that. But this kind of, you know, Puritanitis, that's the inflammation of the Puritan reflex that's been showing up the last 20 years or so. And people are like, oh, you know, drinking is bad and all of that stuff. You know, it begins to put constraints on human beings that people really haven't thought out very well. But yeah, the damage to indigenous cultures when they were forced to quit making their traditional beverages was immense. It can't be overstated at all.
And you already mentioned indigenous cultures using things like cactus and what was the other one, manioc?
Yeah, manioc is, you know, it's mostly a South American, it's called cassava. Tapioca comes from that, which you can sometimes get still. Not many people are into it anymore. But, you know, it's a really good starchy, tuberous root like a potato. It's grown as a primary food staple in a lot of places of Central and South America. And is because it's such a good starch source, it's regularly fermented. The Tarahumara Indians, for instance, they were the ones that began, as far as I know, fermenting agave cactus, which is what tequila comes from. And so the agave sap is extremely sweet, and they would ferment that. And they're, you know, they had very strong ceremonial traditions around fermenting those and drinking those and consuming those. It's pretty much any plant that could be fermented has been. And if it tends to be a primary plant for that culture, then a large amount of sacredness, ceremony begins to surround it. Like in Norway, juniper ales are extremely common, even now still to some extent. And that same kind of sacredness and ceremonial dynamic emerged around juniper as well. And people tended to, for whatever reason, in that whatever area it was, there would be a single plant in general that they would focus on.
Well, I've tried hundreds of beers, and I don't think I've tried any of the tree beers. So that is something, after reading your book, I will certainly be looking for, if not brewing myself, sooner than later.
You know, the easiest way to do that is to just get maple syrup and dilute it. That, you know, if you get some of the people in New England who gather maple sap, still drink it, and I've never actually experienced anything quite like it. It literally is like drinking tree blood. I don't know. I mean, it sounds kind of gross, but I'm not really sure else how to describe it. When you drink it and it's room temperature, it's got this kind of viscosity and this kind of impact where I've never tasted a substance like it. It's the most remarkable experience I've ever had. And then when you ferment it on top of that, it's really quite a remarkable thing. And that was, in the United States, both birch ales and maple ales like that were extremely common for 200 or 300 years. George Washington had it every year. So did, I mean, all of the founding people did. I mean, it was very, very common up until probably and the industrialization, 1850, 1860, I would guess.
How are beers sacred?
Well, for most people, it's just as I was talking about. They're a focus for this particular kind of experience. Many of the cultures that would ferment, like the Papago, they would only ferment once a year when the Papago fruits were ripe enough to begin fermenting them. So they wouldn't necessarily be drinking all of the time. Other cultures, like the Norwegians with juniper ale, they would drink much more frequently. But it was they looked at it as a movement into a non-ordinary reality that was done for a specific reason. And like many things that human beings had before mass production and larger industrialization dynamics took over, it was very much an arts and crafts kind of thing. It was people close to the earth where the power was with the earth or the plants, not with you. You couldn't really control it. So when you went to harvest from a tree or harvest from a plant, you were really clear that it was the gift of that thing coming into the world, that this transformative process occurred with it, where yeast moved into although they didn't have a concept for the word yeast then, but this, they would call it a spirit, they would have various terms for it. They knew, they were identifying it clearly, but in a different way than we would, and it would move into the thing, this relationship would occur, this transformation would occur, and then they would have this beverage to consume that would not only make them stronger overall, increase their health, but it would change their perceptual orientation and capacity. So that in and of itself, it made people be extremely reverent about the things that they were working with. And people then anyway tended to be a great deal more sensitive to shifts in their interior world than we are now. We tend to focus more on the exterior world. I mean, you know, Eskimos have like 20 words for snow. We've got like 3, and we're about that bad with internal states. Like, you know, we use the same word like love. I love broccoli. I love my dog. I love my child. But, you know, there's a lot more subtlety in there than we've developed. But ancient cultures tended to be a lot more sophisticated about shifts in interior perceptual states, and they tended to have words to describe those subtle shifts. So this particular kind of shift, it was a discrete state that they recognized, and they had tremendous reverence for the world or the earth, however you want to look at it, the plant, giving them the gift of that shift of perception.
In your book, you discuss a lot of the origin of fermenting stories from, you know, a woman bringing the story of fermenting, or a young child or something like that. Would you mind discussing that?
Well, every culture that you're in, you've got, there's these stories of the origin of fermentation. And, I mean, they're extremely common, whether you're looking at corn woman bringing corn, even if you're looking at, for instance, in the Americas, the indigenous cultures' use of the pipe and working with tobacco and the sacred pipe and those ceremonies, most people have heard of White Buffalo Calf Woman, which is the Lakota Sioux story. But what's true is that the concept of the pipe was extremely pervasive everywhere, and there's different origin stories. It's just we don't know about most of them, and the same is true with fermentation, because it was such a primary kind of gift. And if you begin to look even at other psychotropic plants like peyote, there's going to be stories of how that came to be in the world. And it's just fascinating that it shows how deeply important these things were to those people because of how it shifted perception and relationship to the exterior world.
So it sounds basically like that in general, intoxicating substances were revered as sacred and or gods and or, you know, some sort of gift from the gods or something of that sort, whether it's alcohol or obviously we call alcohol spirits.
Right.
You know, can you talk about how spirits are connected with alcohol in that sense?
Well, the part of the problem with this kind of a discussion is when we start to get into it, people in our culture tend to come at it from a very kind of a one-dimensional perspective. You know, just for instance, like we're taught in school, or at least I was taught in school. Actually, I think education's gotten worse since then. But in any event, the thing is, we're taught also that the Greeks were, you know, they were great with sculptors, and they were great with all of these, you know, their plays, and their, you know, they discussed democracy and the atom, and you know, and all of these amazing things that they did, and you know, so. We're given this across their whole spectrum. They're amazing, 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 until we get to their discussion of religion. And then we're like, isn't it sad that they were so superstitious and ignorant? They had to believe in many gods, you know. So it's like we've got this really strange sort of orientation about what the world of the sacred is, what these kind of beings that they were discussing are, and what it meant to them. And because our picture is so distorted, it's difficult to talk about that sort of thing. The easiest way to talk about it is that, you know, again, that human beings have the capacity to perceive extremely discrete states of reality with really, really tiny shifts, whether that's their interior world or in state of mind they're working with or what's going on outside of them. So to give you a really easy example, let's say, you know, if you see a little puppy walking across the floor and it doesn't see you yet, you know, and you're just watching it, you know, and like the way little puppies are when they're about 6 weeks old and their back legs walk a little faster than their front legs, and they're just, they've got that kind of energy about them. It's so cute. And so you see the puppy and then you go, here, boy, and the puppy looks up and sees you. And right in that minute, you can feel this energy come out of the puppy and go toward you, and something goes out of you toward the puppy, and the two of you know that it's one of the realest experiences you've ever had, and the puppy bounds over and you touch the puppy, and there's this exchange that's going on that's very discreet, very real. Everybody knows the experience, but we don't have a word for it in our language. But that's an example of a very discreet experience of an invisible that we don't know how to talk about. Okay, now we might subsume it under the word love, but which is not going to be accurate. The Greeks called that specific experience the thesis. It's when the soul and the person goes in, leaves the body, goes into the other thing, and the soul and the other thing leaves its body and goes into the human being. And there's this moment of deeper inspiration. For them, the source of inspiration was the exterior world. It was the exchange of aesthesis. And aesthesis, the word itself, means to breathe in. So you would have this deep inspiration of breathing in and this exchange that was very discreet and real. So we kind of fumble with that. So, but when you start to expand on that and look at what they're dealing with, they're looking at very real, discreet, sophisticated perceptions of states like that. So all of us have had the experience one time or another walking through the forest and encountering a magnificent tree, and we might catch a glimpse of it out of the corner of our eye, and we turn and we go, oh, like that, you know. And that's that breathing in thing. There's this exchange of energy that occurs. There's something more than the sum of the parts in that tree that we have the capacity to perceive. The same is true of ecosystems or ecoranges, like the Grand Canyon is a much larger dynamic than a single tree, but nevertheless, it's got some invisible quality to it that people can feel. So you begin to work with these things that are invisible yet have very profound impacts and very specific kind of reality dynamics. And indigenous and ancient cultures, they experience the whole world with that dimension of invisibility, and they knew how to talk about it. So when you get into fermenting and alcohol, you're getting into a specific area of invisibles that were very discreet and specific for them. This thing about alcohol, you know, one of the things that's very fascinating to do is to get a whole bunch of different kinds of fermented beers that are homemade, okay, and then a bunch of commercial beers, and you begin drinking, you know, some of the, you just begin tasting some of the homemade beers, and then you slowly move into the commercial brand. There's some invisible essence missing in the commercial brands that are very present in the home-brewed ales, and I've done this many times with people, and everybody can notice there's some quality there that isn't present in the commercial brews. And so there's some spirit in that kind that's with the yeast still in the bottle. There's something there that happens. And so indigenous and ancient cultures were extremely good at following those kind of golden threads of meaning or perception and working with them and naming them and specifically regenerating them later to induce certain kinds of experiences or expand perception in certain ways. So to me, it's not unusual at all that alcohol, the word for alcohol would be spirit, because it's really clear in all cultures that it enhances perception of subtle states like that, and that it itself has its own kind of identity that an attentive person who's feeling keenly can also perceive.
You're talking about the Greeks and their how we perceive their pantheistic views, which I think you and I are very on even keel with that. But one thing I wanted to add there or ask you is, are you familiar with, I mentioned his name earlier, Professor Carl Ruck, with his work?
Actually, I'm not familiar with his work.
He wrote a book.
So you've helped my education.
He wrote a book called The Apples of Apollo, which actually argues that all of the Greek gods are psychoactive plant substances. So it's not totally on the same idea that you have, but very similarly related. And in fact, the other book that I mentioned earlier, that I think I mentioned it, The Hidden World, covers that those same themes throughout the European fairy tales and folklores. So I see a very interesting correlation between your and his work, with yours in relation to primarily alcoholic substances and his primarily focused on mushrooms, but he goes into Datura and mead and things like that too. And so it's I find it a very interesting correlation between the both of your work, and that's kind of in large part why I wanted to have you on, because I think you bring such a fascinating picture to all of this together.
No, thanks, John. And, I can see his point for that, but to me, in my own experience, it makes sense to expand it a little beyond that by saying, just if you look at the concept of the earth, or the experience of the earth as a living organism, which James Lovelock gave it the name Gaia, William Gold, I forget which one it was, I always mess that up. But anyway, his neighbor, the guy that wrote Lord of the Flies, anyway, he suggested the word Gaia to him, and which was the old Greek goddess of the earth, if I'm recalling rightly. And that concept of this, when you get a self-organized system, there's something more than the sum of the parts that comes into being. Like, all of us know that when we meet a friend of ours and we see him in a restaurant across the room and we look at this table and no, that's not them. We look at that table and that's not them. And then we see our friend. There's this kind of energy that flashes between us. We know our friend isn't like completely her body or her age or where she was born. There's some substance that we're really aware of that's that thing that at the moment of self-organization that's more than the sum of the parts. So the earth is like that. Ecoregions tend to have it. Mountains very definitely have it. And in many, many traditions, mountain spirits or mountain intelligence is an extremely pervasive and well-established concept. So, and this concept of other beings that have intelligence and awareness but you can't exactly locate in space and time easily, like, the spirit of a particular eco range or a mountain. That taps, for me, as well into the concept of the kind of powerful beings that ancient and indigenous cultures were talking about. So I don't tend to go down just to psychoactive plants because I think it's missing the larger perspective that, you know, and if you look, this concept of ancestors are prevalent, and there's a lot of different sort of ways of looking at that, and I think there's just a lot more going on, and I think the Greeks were onto something, and so that's, and it kind of bears out my experience in a lot of ways.
What three things would you say were the power behind the temperance movement?
Well, there's, I'd kind of separate that out a little bit. The temperance movement I would label as a later phenomenon than the early prohibitions around alcohol. And during the Middle Ages, there was a, there were probably easily 200 or 300 different beers and ales that were commonly consumed all through Europe. And the oldest one was called Gruet. I'm talking now kind of after the fall of Rome and when the Catholic Church had become fairly predominant. The major kind of beer used back then was Gruet, and it was a blend of primarily three herbs, marsh rosemary, myrcogale, and yarrow, and then they would add other stuff for flavor enhancers and things like that. And that beer didn't put the drinker to sleep, and it tended to be highly inebriating and sexually stimulating. And what began to happen was that there were competing groups. There was a monopoly. You had to pay the Catholic Church to make those kind of beers. It was kind of, you know, like the, you know, what our hopped ales are today. And there were some people that were very uncomfortable with how inebriating many of these beers and ales were that other people were drinking. Gruet wasn't just the only one. Henbane ale was, the name for henbane is Pilsner. The original Pilsner was henbane ale, which was extremely psychotropic, and the German berserkers tended to drink a lot of that and then go rape and pillage, which of course irritated all of their neighbors. And so slowly there was this kind of thread of, oh, we don't like people drinking those highly inebriating ones. And besides that, you know, they're very sexually stimulating. We don't like that either. And there were competing merchants who wanted to make different kinds of ales that couldn't break the Catholic monopoly. So they, there was this huge, long-drawn process of, over several centuries, which resulted finally in the German Beer Purity Act, which was about 1516 or something. And it was really, you know, I went into this whole thing assuming it was the Catholics that wanted to stop this, but it was really the Protestants who insisted that hops be the primary plant used in ale and not these others, and primarily because hops puts the drinker to sleep and it dulls sexual drive in the male, and it just made everybody a lot easier to get along with. So I think those are the primary factors that began in that prohibitionist movement back then, and they were kind of rekindled in the temperance movement in our own day. The dislike of people being drunk and the dislike of these kind of substances people taking. The temperance movement wasn't just a prohibitionist movement about alcohol. It was extremely active about outlawing the uses of opiums and over-the-counter drugs of many sorts, cocaine and a whole lot of things. And so our kind of, the FDA came into being as kind of a collaboration between the temperance prohibition movement and the American Medical Association, which gave doctors primary control over those drugs so that people couldn't get them over the counter anymore. And alcohol was just part of that thing, not the primary thing.
Very interesting. So what I find especially interesting with what you just commented on is that that this Gruet, and you know, that it was so psychotropic, and that the Catholics were brewing it. So here we have really a direct tie between psychoactive substances and the Catholic Church's monopoly over brewing.
And, you know, the Catholics were a lot more fun in the early days. The Christian Church had a lot more juice in the early days. And you have to realize they're coming out of a Roman framework. And even though they were going monotheistic, they were coming out of that kind of culture that was a lot more involved with the use of mind-altering substances and what you might call a hedonistic kind of approach to life, and that the kind of prohibitionist, anti-sex, anti-drugs, anti-rock and roll thing that began emerging, that emerged over a long period of time as more and more, I don't know exactly why organizations tend, these control freaks tend to take over them as time goes on and restrict behavior and try to control behavior more and more. But the Catholic Church prior to about 1100 was fairly cool, and they began between 1100 and 1500 got worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. And the Inquisition became more and more of a choice for enforcing behavior as time came on. But early on, they were much more interesting than they were later.
You discussed earlier, I'm just trying to figure out how to formulate the question here. You were discussing about the idea of bread and water and the first fermentation and that sort of thing. And in your book, you mention how fermentation itself may actually be wrapped up in the origins of civilization. Could you go into that?
Yeah, there actually are brewing anthropologists, beer anthropologists, and they're, of course, a very interesting group of people that, go around the world getting drunk, and they get paid for it. I mean, you can't get a better job than that. But, they're starting to find that in Egypt, which is considered to be the primary cradle of what we call civilization now, that the kind of grains that ended up being fermented tended to grow in profusion there already. And so the cultures that moved through that area, there's some evidence that's been emerging, which I tend to like myself, that they settled there because the grains grew in abundance, and they discovered that the grains could be fermented as well as used for food, and so that civilization began when we started drinking, not when we started thinking. And they actually have it the other way around, that, a lot of historians, people settled there and then they discovered fermentation later. But I think the evidence is starting to show that it was really the other way around.
Was alcohol always considered a gift of the gods in all of these cultures?
Yeah, pretty much. I can't find an example where it wasn't. I mean, you don't start getting that kind of separation until you get into industrialization and the Puritan movements. The modern-day kind of temperance movement really does tend to come out of more Puritan Protestant thinking. And, there's that concept that a human being should never experience any kind of childlike joy. And if you do, that's a definition of a Protestant, somebody that knows that somewhere someone's having a good time and they have to put a stop to it, So the thing is that kind of modern thing where it became defined as, Satan or, this bad thing, it's a really strange kind of reversal of what's been true for at least 10,000 years, if not a considerably longer period of time. It's more kind of tied up into people being terrified of human beings having sex, having joy, having this kind of expanded awareness. It's almost as if they adopted this maxim of you must not extend awareness further than our society wants it to go, and then they began enforcing it everywhere. I don't know why they got scared of it. Maybe they had a bad trip or something. I don't know. But whatever it is, it's become a real problem for everybody.
Yeah, and as I call it in my book and a DVD that I wrote and produced with Andrew Taji, the Pharmacratic Inquisition that we coined from Jonathan Ott, who I think you're familiar with his work somewhat.
Yes, I am, and that's the Pharmacratic Inquisition. That's a very nice phrase. I was looking at it again today and decided to immediately steal that for myself.
Yeah, have you seen my DVD called The Pharmacratic Inquisition?
I have not watched it, but I have seen it.
Okay. Okay. Do we have any idea? You mentioned Egypt. I guess this might be kind of a weird question, but do we have any idea where fermentation was thought to originate, and how did not geographically speaking, but as in how did the tribes get the spirit of fermentation into the wort to start it fermenting?
Well, I found the neatest kind of stories in detail about that in both the Norwegian accounts and the Papago accounts, and they're remarkably similar. And you have to realize one's in southern Arizona and one's in, you know, Scandinavia. So they're very different in geography and time, but nevertheless, their stories are quite similar. And what they would basically do is, when you really begin to examine their work, is they were very clear. Once again, I'm talking about that their ability to perceive extremely subtle yet discrete states. And they were really clear that they could feel the difference between the kind of the yeast that we would normally now use for beer and, for instance, a lactobacillus. I mean, it's very common if you get an infection in your wort, you'll get a lactobacillus in there, which will still create alcohol. And you get those in lambics, which are Belgian wild fermented ales, that they'll have some lactobacillus in there, and it tastes like a kind of sour Chardonnay, which some people really like. I've actually made a lactobacillus, or basically a St. John's wort lambic, and it tastes very much like a slightly sour Chardonnay, and it's a very nice antidepressant, too, because of St. John's wort, and it's got this kind of pale pink color to it. It's kind of a nice ale. But anyway, a lot of people don't like those lactobacillus fermented ales because they're just sour. They're not as much fun. And these other yeasts that are more commonly used in beer, so both the Papago and the Norwegians were really clear that they could tell the difference in lactobacillus is actually a bacteria, but I'll just call it a yeast to make it easy, but they could tell the difference in those two fermenting agents and those two yeasts. And so they would do very specific ceremonies in which they would work to call the specific yeast in that they wanted to ferment in. And they were really clear that they knew how to do that. They would tend to save the yeasts. In Norway, they would use a yeast log they would put in the bottom of the fermenting vat. It would be open grain wood, and the yeast would get in there, and they would just drop that into each succeeding wort that they were making. And the Papagos tended to ferment in baskets, which would hold that as well. But they were extremely clear they were looking for one specific kind of yeast. And when you look at the plant work that people did, the indigenous and ancient peoples did, they were really clear they could tell the difference in the spirit of each plant by how it felt. And so to us now, it sounds like they might be making stuff up, but they were capable of tremendous sensitivity like we are. We just aren't trained in it from birth like many of them were.
What is aqua vitae?
Oh, that's basically, its real meaning is water of life, and that's what they came to call the active substance in a fermented beverage, aqua vitae, that it was, they would say, oh, there's the water of life in here. And to them, it was, a remarkable transformative process that was a gift from the wildness of the world or the sacredness of the world. They didn't have the sense that they could control it, so they would bring this process. They would have a plant, and they would have some water, and they would have some sugar, and then it would undergo this amazing transformation. And so that active substance which changed perception they called water of life.
What can you say about the Eleusinian mysteries and the sacred drink Kaikion? And are you familiar with the proposal that, again, Ruck that I mentioned earlier and Gordon Wasson and Albert Hoffman and now as well Peter Webster have proposed in regard to that with ergot?
Yeah, I was actually just reading over Gordon Wasson and Albert Hoffman's material on that not too long ago. And, you know, Albert Hoffman was making the case, and a good one, I think, that there was a grain ergot involved in the Eleusinian mysteries. And there's a number of fascinating things about those mysteries that the Greeks held for, what do you remember? It was over 1,000 years that they held it every year. It was a very long time.
And yeah.
Until it was finally outlawed by the Christian church about what?
It was 4th or 5th century. What's that?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, something like that. And so, and what's fascinating is thousands upon thousands of people over, you know, this incredibly long period of time, 1,000 years, participated in it, and not one of them ever revealed what happened in the inner mysteries. I mean, that's astonishing. I mean, you can't get, you know, I can't keep a secret between myself, you know, it always gets out, but, you know, that all of those people could keep that like that, and so nobody really knows what went on except that there was the box that had the engraving of the ear of corn on it, and there was a glass in there and things like that. So, you know, and because fermenting was so big there, you know, there's some sort of connection to fermenting and grain and all of that, but Hoffman was making this point that if it was an ergot on the grain, which is what LSD comes from, a rye ergot, that basically then that would explain the tremendous impact at the final ceremonies would have on everybody. And also what's fascinating is people of every religious orientation would participate in those mysteries. It wasn't, you know, you could have Christians in it and everybody else. And it seemed to make their own faith stronger, and they didn't get into this competitive thing about my way or the highway kind of thing. So I actually think that his point is a good one, and that there's a fairly good chance that it was a fermented grain ergot that they were taking during those ceremonies. I think that would be a fairly remarkable kind of experience.
Well, there's an updated, there was an error found in, I believe, Hoffman's original proposal, and it had, for many years, the book was kind of laid aside as supposedly debunked, and then just in the last few weeks or a couple months, a new edition of the book has been released with Peter Webster in it, and Peter Webster is actually gone through and found the errors and corrected Hoffman's original theory, resubstantiating the whole ergot proposal. So it's if you haven't
I haven't read the new one.
Yeah, but go ahead. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying I think that his point was well made, and I think there's a lot of merit to it. The, you know, and once again, it's this kind of you know, we still have this concept when we talk about psychotropics that it's in some other category, you know, this is how we are normally, and then it makes us abnormal or, you know, whatever. But actually, human beings experience a wide range of states of perception and states of awareness all of the time. We move from one to the other continually. It's much more, it makes a lot more sense to think of us as, you know, functional or semi-functional multiple personalities with multiple perceptual capacities. And multiple personality disorder, in a lot of ways, is just simply a disease of a general condition that we all have. And so we're naturally made to move into different states of perception continually from millisecond to millisecond to millisecond because we're nonlinear organisms. We're not just single points of view. And so to encounter psychotropic substances like that, we're made to do that. It's a natural part of life. It's not abnormal. It's not weird. It's not something that should be avoided. That really comes out of that Puritan orientation. So when they talk about this, I know part of what their focus is, they're trying to make a historical point about it to say, you know, look, this was this thing, and you know, they're trying to address this kind of, you know, separation of our perceptual awarenesses into categories of normal and altered and stuff. But really, you know, I think Hoffman was capturing a really good point. He was a really remarkable man in that this was just a normal part of human life, and this is just one specific example of how perception was shifted using plant intake. So, yeah, I think I'm a big fan of his work, actually.
Many cultures say that the plants actually speak to them, and you've kind of hinted on that today. And I think you even have a book called The Language of Plants. Can you discuss this more? Do plants talk? Is that just some crazy, wild, non-scientific pseudoscience, or what is that?
Well, what we're really discussing in that, I do have a book called The Lost Language of Plants, and another one, The Secret Teachings of Plants, and then a book called Sacred Plant Medicine. And those three, as well as the book that we're talking about today, the beer book, they all kind of touch on that dynamic in their own ways. And the thing is that we're not talking about talking in the sense, we're talking about language. And, you know, everything that exists possesses language. The language that we have when we talk about language like English or French or something, that's just a specific instance of language. So what we're dealing with, like for instance, when a baby is born, a human baby, they don't have language, but nevertheless, in the way we think about it, but nevertheless, they engage in the communication of meaning. They engage meanings directly, and they go back and forth, and then slowly they begin to learn words to represent things. And at that point, they tend to begin to move away from meanings themselves and begin to work with signs. You know, Goethe, the great German poet, made a really important point about it. He said how difficult it is to keep the thing livingly in front of one and not to slay it with the word. And what he was trying to describe was how to move out of the statistical mentality, how to move out of the neocortex, or how to move out of linguistic framework into the direct perception of meaning, just like we did when we were infants. We all have that capacity to do that still, even if it's buried under years of schooling. And, you know, when I was talking about that experience of the puppy or your friend at a restaurant, that was an direct experience of meaning. It happens with some other part of the self than the brain. And indigenous and ancient cultures were extremely clear about using that capacity for perception to work with plants or anything else that they might be encountering. And every indigenous culture, every medicine person ever asked, you know, when they first made contact with Europeans who were coming over, and if they were asked, well, how did you learn the uses of your plant medicines? Every one of them said, you know, they said, the plant told me, I learned it in a dream or a vision, the gods told me, something along that kind of a description. And, you know, so the people reporting it would always go, oh, isn't it sad they're so superstitious that they have to make this up? But nevertheless, you know, every one of them said that. And to me, the fundamental thing about science, if you're going to use that as an approach to understanding the world, is that when you get a phenomenon that shows up over and over and over extremely consistently throughout culture, irrespective of geography or of time, then you go, wow, okay, let's see what are they all making up the same story? It's absurd. Of course there's got to be some root thing happening. And the scientists say, well, of course they learned the uses of these plants by cause and effect. But the indigenous peoples themselves said, no, we didn't learn them cause and effect. So for instance, you know, yarrow is used to stop bleeding in every culture and every place where it grows. And so they say the scientists say, of course, well, that was a cause and effect thing. You just started to bleed, you put a plant on it. But you have to think what that's like. They're sitting around bleeding and they go, oh, let's put a plant on it. That's a huge leap. So, but let's say they do it and then they're bleeding really bad and they just start trying all the different plants, you know, until they finally find yarrow. I mean, it sort of makes sense. But when you get to a plant like cedar, which specifically is used to ward off negative influences, okay, or maleficent powers, okay, negative energies or spirits of some sort. So you can imagine, you know, there's this same guy who would cut himself and was bleeding, but now he's in the forest, and all of a sudden he becomes aware of a negative spirit, you know. So he's racing through the forest going, he tries yarrow, it doesn't work, he tries cherry, you know, he tries all these things, and he finally gets to cedar, and he holds it up, and it dissipates the spirit. So, you know, we're already in a cause and effect problem right here because scientists aren't going to agree that there's such a thing as negative spirits. But nevertheless, in every place cedar grows, that's what they say it's used for. So that capacity of perceiving directly with this other part of the self and perceiving the language or perceiving the communication of a thing without the intermediary of language. And Goethe, one of the things that he did was he talked in detail about how you do that, and he made a number of major contributions to the understanding of vertebrate anatomy and plant, the metamorphosis of plants from using the exact techniques he talked about. Luther Burbank co-created with plants over 300 of the plants we regularly use for food and ornamentals, doing exactly the same thing and described it almost the exact same way. Henry David Thoreau said that's exactly what he did. And the indigenous peoples, when you look at it, that's exactly what they described they did. So this capacity for communication is there. The thing, the very first thing, the major hurdle to get over is learning to see everything that's alive out there as equivalent to a human being. As the Winnebago, this one Winnebago medicine man said, you must treat your plants as human beings because then they will put forth their best efforts on your behalf and you won't be embarrassed in your medicines. And that concept of treating everything like a human being is equivalent to human beings, no higher or lower than, is extremely important for being able to establish that kind of communication. Because, I mean, just think about it. If you are being in relationship with somebody and you assume and you treat them like a thing, it's very hard to even perceive anything that they're communicating to you of intelligence. And also, why would they want to?
Very interesting. What concept or idea about your research, other than that phenomenal statement that you just made, would you like listeners to go away with from this podcast?
Well, the primary thing that I really encourage people to do more and more all of the time is, you know, we're in this huge mess. Everybody knows that there's something wrong. The experts are really who got us into this mess. And the only way we're going to get out, I believe, is if people began to follow their own intuitive self-wisdom from the beginning, that they pay attention to their feelings. If they have a feeling about something, there's a reason for it. We walk into one restaurant, it feels comfortable. We walk into another one, and it feels very uncomfortable. We have the capacity to reach out with some non-physical part of ourselves and touch the world and gather information that way. And when we're touched by things, we have certain feeling responses. It's very important to pay attention to those. We become aware when we do of what the poet William Stafford called golden threads that touch us, and we begin to follow them. Or as Bly put it, we follow tiny impulses through the meadow of language, you know, in this instance, through the meadow of meaning that we wander through in the world. Those things tend to lead us to where we're meant to be and the things that we're meant to do. That's crucially important. And Barbara McClintock, who won the Nobel Prize for her work with corn transposons, said, you must have a feeling for the organism. And that's what she was talking about. She described it very much that way, following those tiny impulses of feeling from one thing to the next. And the next thing she said, you must learn to see. Before you do anything else, you must learn to see what's right in front of you. And that's the hardest thing that there is. All of us miss that stuff all of the time. Beginning to see what plants do in ecosystems, how they move from one place to the other, how they produce different chemicals at one time or another, and those chemicals are dispersed through mycelial networks under the soil to all of the other plants that need them in the area. Once you realize, or as Thoreau said, he goes, you must understand that nothing is what you've taken it to be. If you can get to that place and begin to really look at the world with the eyes of a child without preconception and begin to go, what's really there, and you begin to follow those feelings, what happens is this whole world is opened up, the world that really is there rather than the world we're taught there, and we begin to find what our own ecological function, what our own ecological purpose is in the scheme of things, and doing that thing is the thing that we need to do to change everything.
Very well said. Would you like to plug your website and mention the books that you've authored and given any contact information out that you may or may not want to give?
Well, people are perfectly willing to look at my website, which is www.gaianstudies.org, GAIANstudies.org. And I have all my books listed there. I'm up to 12 now, and I'm working on another new one. So I love writing. It's one of the most enjoyable things for me. And I speak about 6 months out of the year various places, so my workshops and things are listed, and people can kind of keep in touch that way.
What is your website?
www.gaianstudies.org. GAIANstudies.org.
And we've been speaking with Stephen Booner, author of Sacred and Herbal Healing Beers, amongst many other books. And Stephen, this has been a fantastic interview. I really appreciate your time for coming on. And
you're welcome, Jan. I appreciate you asking.
Yeah, and I look forward to your future projects.
Okay, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.